Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Say that they would rather switch than fight.
Today's Peter B. Collins podcast in-depth interview is for John Zwiebel in Hawaii. He's been bugging me for months. Peter, you got to get Shahid Buttar on your podcast. Well, the deal is done, and the man who is fighting the power, taking on Nancy Pelosi for her seat in San Francisco, Shahid Buttar, who has made many visits to the Peter B. Collins podcast, returns today. Shahid, it's great to talk to you again.
It's great to be with you again, Peter. Sue, thanks for having me, and thanks for putting the Public Enemy Fight the Power track on as an intro. It flatters me and warms my heart.
Well, you are taking on more than just an individual. This is a very sweeping effort at dramatic change. And first and foremost, Shahid, I want to open with a couple of disclosures. One is that I'm not a Democrat. I left the Democratic Party a long time ago. And the other is, before I actually left the Democratic Party, I worked on a campaign for Nancy Pelosi back in 1996. I was her media advisor, and we did a TV.
I did not know that.
Yeah, we did a TV infomercial to raise the visibility of Ellen Tauscher, who was a newcomer who served, I think, about 10 terms from the East Bay, and also a candidate who didn't win. It was Michaela Alioto, who was running up in the Napa County area. At any rate, I just want you to know that because I do have some history with Speaker Pelosi, and I have been sharply critical of many of her moves as Speaker, and so it won't come as a surprise to you that I welcome your candidacy. And I've been following it very carefully. Your social media presence is very strong, and I commend you for the Facebook ad campaign that you run on a daily basis. And you raise a lot of important issues that resonate with me. So let me begin with this. Why are you running as a Democrat? You are extremely progressive. You're, nominally a socialist Democrat or a Democratic socialist. But do you find that the party is a reasonable vehicle for the views and positions that you hold and espouse?
The Democratic Party certainly has not historically been an active agent promoting values like peace in the face of militarism and a human right to health care and housing and food. But I don't think that means it can't be. The very reason I'm running as a Democrat against the party leader is precisely to help shift the party's direction. I'd say that there is a wide spectrum of voices within the party. Representative Ocasio-Cortez has made this point that in no other country would someone like her and someone like Joe Biden be lumped together in the same party. It's frankly absurd that, someone as conservative as Joe Biden shares the same party with voices like ours. And at the same time, there is basically an ongoing fight going on within and across the country over, are we going to be a Democratic Party more like Joe Biden, one that defers to the past and doubles down on many of our failed predatory corporate policies and engineers future crises, or are we going to be a party that leans into the transformative vision offered by the Squad that puts communities before corporations, that puts sustainability before resource extraction and plunder, that puts future generations before the greed of the present, and that puts people before capital. Ultimately, I think that's the vision that America needs. And it's one that we can achieve, certainly not through the Democratic Party as it's currently constituted, but if we knock out some figureheads and send signals to the rest of the party. And one signal I aim to send to the party is that if you are an urban centrist Democrat and you don't show up for your communities will show you the door. And if we are able to remove the strongest corporate Democrat in the entire body, I think that signal will be one that the rest of them will be very hard pressed to ignore.
Mm-hmm. Shahid, you and I go back to the Bush years when you were the founder and executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And I really bonded with you and the battles that you took on. And I wonder if you would comment on the arc of the Democratic Party since the Bush years, because I've been very troubled that it had a huge anti-war component when the wars were Republican wars. But under Obama, the anti-war wing largely went silent. Medea Benjamin, who endorses you, has told me that Code Pink went from like 120 chapters across the country to maybe a dozen. And the whole, what I consider to be the largely exaggerated Russiagate scandal has led the Democrats into a sharp neocon direction. And the most notable recent example was when the Democrats and Jason Crow from Colorado teamed up with Liz Cheney to build on this unproven story that Russia paid bounties to Taliban fighters to kill Americans in Afghanistan, to pass an amendment to the defense funding bill, the NDAA, that essentially ties any president's hands from completely withdrawing from Afghanistan. And to me, that is almost the example of a kind of full shift, a 180-degree shift of the Democratic Party.
You're on to something there, and I share this concern. People forget that the particular reason that then-President Obama became the president in 2008, during the campaign, he differentiated himself from Hillary Clinton as being the anti-war candidate. He was the only candidate in the field who had opposed the Iraq War from the start. And there's something really important there to grip really beyond the foreign policy. And this is, I'll come back to the anti-war movement and our sort of challenges in the years since in just a second, but this is a point worth making. You know, the reason that Barack Obama was able to plausibly make that case to the American people is because he was an outsider to Washington, as have been, frankly, every U.S. president in the last at least 40 years, with the one exception of George H.W. Bush. And Jimmy Carter comes to Washington as a peanut farmer. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan as an actor from the West Coast. George H.W. Bush was the head of the CIA, so he's very much an outlier to this pattern. But Bill Clinton, Arkansas governor. George W. Bush, yes, his father was the president, and yes, he was the governor of Texas, but he presented himself as a small-town yokel. Hmm. Barack Obama, first-term U.S. senator, right? The idea that you win the White House by nominating creatures of Washington, that hasn't been true in at least half a century. And in 2016, Democrats nominated a U.S. senator who had served for decades and was sort of the embodiment of Washington. And again, in 2020, our nominee is someone who is as much a creature of Washington as anyone else in the entire party, and they expect to win. And it is disturbing to me because, again, if there's any through thread of the last many elections, it is throw the bums out and put in a newcomer, because, frankly, Washington has so thoroughly delegitimated itself that the American people not only are over it and tired of the two parties, but they've been tired of the two parties. This isn't a new phenomenon. This goes back decades, and it's immediately apparent in the objective data. And yet still Democrats, you know, seem to duck into punches. And I think the dynamic that you're describing on foreign policy is a perfect example. We saw that the majority of the American public favored a vision that was skeptical of military adventurism, that was supportive of human rights, that was supportive of transparency and skeptical of executive lies that keep dragging us from one war to another, from Vietnam to Iraq. You know, our wars are normally based on lies. And those lies, at least in those cases, have revealed themselves. In Afghanistan, too, the Washington Post ran a story sort of in, I think, December 2019, documenting that every example of supposed progress that we've been told about in Afghanistan for the last 20 years has been based on fraud and misrepresentation. And if that's where we're at, you know, I'd remind people also, Afghanistan has a somewhat unique role in global history. It is the only country that multiple empires have shattered trying to attack. So it was the attempted occupation of Afghanistan that broke both the British Empire and the Russian Empire. And it might be seeming to do the same thing to the American one. And I do hope that we don't forget the lessons that we've learned of the last many years, that our military-industrial complex has been, if anything, consistently committed to creating national security threats rather than reducing them. And Afghanistan, again, makes the point very clearly, before we invaded, 20 years before we invaded, we trained the people that we invaded to try to kill, right? I mean, we trained Al-Qaeda as the Mujahideen to fight the Soviets. And then, you know, they got off the leash and came after us. And this idea of the CIA helping national security is just a complete, it requires sticking one's head in the sand, because if anything, our national security agencies and our military industrial complex and our wars for plunder, they don't help U.S. national security. They very actively and demonstrably and consistently undermine it.
Well, and again, I referenced the Russiagate narrative because we're seeing one of the Mueller top attorneys is coming out now. He's got a book to sell. So he's admitting that Mueller pulled up short. I refer to it, you know, as a limited hangout investigation from start to finish. But I do believe he established that Trump attempted to obstruct justice in many ways. And yet we see the Democrats, you know, continue to harp on this idea that Russia hacked the DNC, even though the CrowdStrike VP, Sean Henry, said, well, actually, we never got any evidence that they pulled anything out of the servers. We just assessed that it was Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. And the investment in that whole, you know, unproven narrative for 3.5 years, then that was all jettisoned when they finally impeached Trump, which I initially supported. But the way they attempted impeachment on the narrow issues of Ukraine, without including even the clear criminal behavior that is established in the Michael Cohen plea deal and his sentencing to prison. And so it just strikes me that the Democrats have been, you know, very weak on policy, very weak on politics as the you know, party that is playing defense, and that there are just so many failings that really, you know, do rise to the level of removing the speaker.
No question. I would say that to describe the party as weak in these arenas is charitable, because the party is either weak or it is co-opted and actively complicit, and it very well could be the latter. As a challenger to Nancy Pelosi, I'm the first Democrat in 30 years to reach a November election against her. I have given up any interest in figuring out which one of those is. Is it weakness of a party that just doesn't know how to defend its own principles? Or is it a bug, so to speak? Or is it a feature of a party that is committed to capital and remains unwilling to reveal it, you know, in which there is this dog and pony show? And the facts certainly seem to indicate that either of those narratives fit. Again, my interest is just in making sure that San Francisco is represented faithfully in Congress and that there is actual real opposition to fascism as it emerges. You know, you mentioned before, I just wanted to offer a quick correction. I didn't found the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. I wasn't there at the beginning, but I was hired by the board to be the executive director to replace the founding director.
Okay.
And, you know, from that era, I've long been concerned about this threat presented to democracy by an intersection of issues, the intersection of executive secrecy, of the suppression of dissent, of authoritarian policies that inhibit expression like surveillance, like street violence, and the ultimate project of dismantling democracy and creating fascism in its place. And this isn't a new fear for me. A lot of people have become recently alarmed, whether in the wake of Justice Ginsburg dying or the DHS goon squad in Portland, or whether it was simply the election of an aspiring tyrant. I've feared fascism in the United States in those terms since 2000.
Mm-hmm.
because I've seen this trend. You know, in 2000, the Supreme Court decided to pack itself by choosing the presidency, and all kinds of things have gone off the rails ever since. One point I think that's worth raising on impeachment, which you raise, just to, you know, make this clear for your listeners, the impeachment charade that Nancy Pelosi finally showed up for a year after delaying it was just that, a charade. It was a veneer of accountability, and it was because particularly she limited the process to a single partisan crime. And there's no reason to ever believe that any U.S. senator from the Republican Party would care if the president invited foreign interference in an election. It's a partisan crime. So, of course, it wasn't going to move in the Senate. She basically gave up the process at the beginning. And I don't say that as a Monday morning quarterback. I wrote an article a year before she finally showed up explaining how to do it right. And it's exactly what she refused to do. Emoluments. There's a clause in the Constitution that prohibits self-enrichment at public expense, which is all this criminal president ever does. It's his only interest, is enriching himself at public expense. And that's the ground that could have brought him down. That's the offense that is bipartisan. Conservatives care as much as progressives about not having presidents steal from their families. And Nancy Pelosi, I think largely because, you know, to a theme you raised before, largely because the Democratic Party is, frankly, so much like the Republican Party, both in method and substance, that she didn't feel like she could go there. And when the party, the opposition party, lives in a glass house and is unable to hold a aspiring tyrant accountable for his corruption, that means that we, the people, are paying very profound constitutional costs for the corporate corruption of the Democratic Party.
And Shahid, at BORDC, and also in your subsequent work at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and let me slip in that you're a Stanford Law graduate, you have taken the surveillance issues very seriously. And just a quick story, the last time I saw Nancy Pelosi was at a memorial for a TV reporter who had passed away here in San Francisco. And we chatted for a little bit, and as it was clear she was about to move on, I said, Nancy, I know you have many things on your agenda, but I want my Fourth Amendment back. And there was a pause, and then she smiled and gave me that kind of junior league look. And she said, Peter, it's so good to see you. Now, rewinding a few years, it was in 2005 that I interviewed Nancy Pelosi in Washington, and Kyle Hentz was there, and Kyle was a representative for the Jersey girls and the families of 9/11, survivors of 9/11. And we gave her a copy of David Ray Griffin's book, A New Pearl Harbor. And I got that same look from her. And so I tell you these anecdotes just to punctuate that she was a part of the Gang of Eight. She was on the Intelligence Committee, and then she rose into the leadership. And so she was aware of the creeping expansion of domestic surveillance under Bush, and she helped cement it in place under Obama. And these are matters that I care very deeply about, and without over-personalizing it, I hold her responsible for her role in the erosion of our rights under the Bill of Rights.
You should. I hope to do the same. And I think that this issue is a really revealing demonstration of the character of the incumbent's tenure. And it brings me no pleasure to say that Nancy Pelosi has been an architect of the bipartisan surveillance state. And the bipartisan aspect of the surveillance state is what particularly reveals fascism in the United States, because it's not a political project. It's not just Republicans. Democrats are up to their neck in it. And so many things to say here. You were pressed before on Nancy Pelosi's role in the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence before becoming the House Speaker. She was the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Interestingly enough, Dianne Feinstein, who is also from our city, San Francisco, U.S. Senator, she chaired the Senate Intelligence Committee for years. And it is just interesting the role of San Francisco politicians in having overseen different aspects of the surveillance state over the last 30 years. And I am aghast by it. It offends our city's sensibilities. It offends international human rights. It particularly undermines speech. And this is the point I would love for your listeners to understand. And I fear that Nancy Pelosi maybe doesn't get it. And it doesn't surprise me, because she doesn't have a background as a dissident or a resistor or a journalist. You know, she was a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. So she went to Washington as an agent of the establishment. I've spent my 20 years in politics fighting her and the rest of our leaders from the left. I understand both why people need privacy, particularly vulnerable people can't speak if they don't have privacy. If you're gay in the South, or you're Muslim in Alabama, or you're Mormon in San Francisco, or you're from San Francisco and Salt Lake, maybe. I don't know. There's lots of different contexts in which somebody might be placed at risk by their identity and their speech being both publicly associated. And we've long had constitutional protections for anonymity, not because it protects privacy, though that too, but specifically because it enables dissent and therefore supports democracy. People think that privacy is the thing we lose in a surveillance state. And it's frankly the first of the things we lose. But when we lose the capacity to dissent because we have created thought police, that is the moment at which our democracy has died. And it's not the kind of thing you can resuscitate easily. It is a very fragile norm. And figures like Nancy Pelosi have been in Congress for 30 years swearing oaths to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and not even realizing that because of their governance, they themselves have emerged as a domestic enemy of the Constitution. That's precisely why I'm running for office, because the incumbent has, again, this is the question of, is it a bug, is it a feature, has either violated the oath of office or demonstrably, repeatedly demonstrated that she doesn't understand what it means. And this is, there's too much at stake to be electing members to Congress who don't understand the job, who don't understand that the first role of Congress, the first responsibility of Congress, is to fight, check, and balance and limit the executive branch on behalf of we the people of the United States. And this issue of surveillance is one that I take very seriously. And I go back to the warnings of an even earlier figure than Nancy Pelosi. You know, it would have been 20 years, 30 years before she went to Congress. President Eisenhower warned us all this would happen. And I studied history too closely to ignore it. And I see the incumbent, unfortunately, drag our civilization into authoritarian pitfalls. And I'm tired of saying I told you so, and I would like to help us step over them for a change.
Shahid, some of the preeminent issues of the moment relate to police reform, criminal justice reform, prison reform, which unfortunately is kind of in second place or even third place in the agendas that are being put forward. But I watched the online Democratic convention with interest because everybody used a line that led up to Black Lives Matter. And, you know, they were making a big deal out of lionizing John Lewis, who is a man I got to know a little bit, and I do have high regard for him. But they used his passing as a way of papering over the real issues that Black Lives Matter protests are about. And so here was Joe Biden intoning the Black Lives Matter, and he has been the biggest offender in erecting the police state in this country, of criminalizing the behavior of African Americans to a much greater degree than white counterparts. Kamala Harris has a very uneven history as a district attorney in San Francisco and the attorney general of California. And so as a ticket, they appropriate the name Black Lives Matter without embracing the deep reforms that the movement calls for.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I'll address this both with respect to Biden and Harris, and then separately with respect to Pelosi. It is this fits with the theme of the discussion we were having around the anti-war movement and the way that the lessons of the 2008 election have been lost on Democrats since. This is a moment to very sharply differentiate the presidential ticket from that of the right-wing populist in the White House, the maniac aspiring tyrant Donald Trump. And what the Democrats have managed to do is skew their own process to contrive the selection of the two people who are closest to him. Or at least Biden. I don't want to say that about Senator Harris, because her record as a senator has at least been far to her own left as a prosecutor. But she was not a progressive prosecutor. She was a vicious, predatory prosecutor. She locked up parents for the acts of their kids, which is frankly, you know, beyond the normal abuses of our criminal justice system. And the idea that the architect of the 90s crime bill under Clinton, and a prosecutor who jailed parents for their children's truancy, I think that those are very revealing, disappointing, complicit concessions to a right wing that preceded us, even as our entire political culture is declaring our commitment to basic principles of due process and human rights. And it is profoundly tone deaf. You know, Democrats have a habit of not only not winning elections, but affirmatively losing elections. And if they lose this election, it's because they put Biden up at a moment in time when he was the last person that the American people wanted. This is not a voice. This is not a time to be promoting conservatism within the Democratic Party. And I hesitate to make this point too strongly, but there's an open case as to between Biden and Trump, who has actually done more to damage the American public. Because Trump obviously is an autocrat. He's had 4 years of lies and inciting violence and demeaning people and all the assaults on our republic that he has committed, versus Joe Biden, who's had a 40-year record of actually passing legislation that preys on communities, vulnerable communities, while bragging about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is amazing to me that Democrats thought that the way to beat Trump would be to nominate the person most like him. And it just reveals the fecklessness of the party to pivot from the presidential ticket to my opponent in the general election, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. It was a few months before the party convention, I guess it would have been about 3 or 4 months before, that in response to the very assertive grassroots movement around the country, the House, with Pelosi's support, passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. And there's so many things here that are worth noting. First, when Nancy Pelosi showed up at the press conference introducing the bill, even after millions of us had been in the streets for weeks chanting, "Say their names," she couldn't get his name right, which I just thought was so incredibly revealing that you know, it would be so hard for so many people in the country to get George Floyd's name wrong just because we've been chanting it for weeks, and she very clearly was not. Because she couldn't even get his name right at the bill named after him. And substantively, the bill that she introduced, named after George Floyd, expanded police budgets and expanded police surveillance in direct opposition to the movement's demands. And, you know, the audacity is hard to describe. In all fairness, I will say that the Justice in Policing Act did include a whole host of very helpful measures to advance civil rights, none of which Nancy Pelosi has ever supported in the past, many of which I have spent the better part of 10 years trying to advocate for. And so I've watched in the course of this year's mobilization surrounding the continuing assault on the lives of our black neighbors, I watched the Democratic Party basically disown its own legacy, Nancy Pelosi show up far to her left, still manage to construct a bill to expand police budgets and put money in the pockets of paramilitary corporate contractors, and then forget the name of the person in whose name we've been chanting for justice for weeks at the time. And it just reflects, and you know, doing this while wearing kente cloth, kneeling in Congress, I'm so tired of political theater. And I think America is too. We don't want kente cloth. We don't want figures kneeling in the House. We don't want bills named after fallen heroes that the legislators can't even remember. We just want to make it home at night. And it's not a lot to ask. And we need members of Congress who understand that and are willing to show up for those reforms. One piece on policing, I find myself compelled to always reflect upon at any opportunity, and I know you remember this. There is a widely forgotten moment. Well, it's not a moment. It unfortunately went on and is still going on in some respects, but an era in U.S. history when the Central Intelligence Agency was facilitating and driving the movement towards paramilitarizing police departments across the United States, particularly by the CIA was running crack cocaine into the United States in the 90s. This is documented fact. There was a journalist, Gary Webb, who I know you know well, Peter B., who, yeah, you know, unfortunately met an untimely demise in what was described as a suicide, even though it involved 2 gunshot wounds to the head. Figure that out. And what Gary Webb established was that the Central Intelligence Agency was funding, training, and equipping narco traffickers who were then killing U.S. cops. And that was the point at which we got both an acceleration of mass incarceration and the militarization of police. And in the last 30 years, particularly in the last 5, as people have been responding to the militarized policing, suppressing dissent pattern across the country, people have very largely ignored the CIA's role in all this. And that's incredibly dangerous because the agency never paid a price of any kind. It didn't lose any budgetary authority. It didn't lose any legal authorities. The CIA budget remains classified to this day. No one even knows what we spend on the agency that trained the Mujahideen, doubled down on mass incarceration, lied us into a war, and has possibly been complicit in four different coups across Latin America in the last 2 years alone. This pattern of our national, I'm using air quotes, national security agencies undermining human rights, not just abroad, but also across the U.S., is a critical theme for me inspiring my run for Congress, because I frankly wouldn't be doing it otherwise. I see, and I have long seen, the specter of authoritarianism rising within the U.S. long before most Democrats understood what was happening. Many smug liberals have laughed at me over the last 15 years as I've tried to warn them what is happening under their feet, in many cases with their active participation, but without sufficient sophistication to understand what was happening. And we need members of Congress who are sufficiently sophisticated to understand the implication of the oath of office and stand for it when it matters.
Shahid, one of the other long-term changes of the Democratic Party, and I credit my friend Thomas Frank, who originally wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, and then he wrote Listen Liberal, which is an important book for lefties to absorb. But the Democrats have shifted dramatically from representing the working class to a professional class, the Silicon Valley model. And the last time you and I got together, it was a long time ago, we strolled the streets of Berkeley during the Occupy encampment there. And I believe Occupy was a very valuable effort that did help raise awareness of the dramatic gulf of wealth and income between the top 1% and the rest of us. And the Democrats responded with a kind of AstroTurf group called Occupy Democrats. And they tried to co-opt the energy of the movement, similar to the manner in which they're handling Black Lives Matter here in 2020. But the shift away, I think, has undermined the leverage that they should have at the moment to be able to force the Republicans into a new relief package, including bailout money for state and local government. And yet they, in my view, they have lost that linkage and credibility with working class and working families in the United States.
There's no question, and there's a really troubling and frankly confusing chicken and egg problem here, because it's hard to know, and I think it's a bit of both. Is this dynamic caused by the erosion of organized labor, or is it driven and facilitated by the co-optation of what vestiges of organized labor remain? Long in our history, particularly in the years since the robber barons and the Second World War especially, we had increasing rates of labor mobilization and participation. And organized labor was able to particularly compel compliance from Democrats. When labor was ascendant and active and independent of electoral politics, it was an agent of accountability to ensure that politicians didn't just ignore the interests of working class people. Now, in the last 30 years, as Democrats have historically slid to the right and embraced a much more corporate-friendly content of a platform and style of governance, one of the predictable consequences has been that labor has continued to lose ground because there aren't adequate protections for organized labor in the law. Democrats just haven't gone to bat for labor and working class people in the better part of a generation. And that is, again, both a cause and an effect. I have a hard time overlooking, though, at the same time, the co-optation of what organized labor remains. So here in San Francisco, I'm running against the corporate Speaker of the House. Nancy Pelosi refuses to embrace healthcare as a human right. Her response to the pandemic was to prioritize tax breaks for millionaires before rent and mortgage relief, at the same time that she approved a unprecedented $750 billion military budget for this aspiring tyrant and expanding his surveillance power. She authorized one-time $1,200 payment to some tax filers, which is to say, Nancy Pelosi is doing, frankly, nothing to address the challenges of working people struggling in the face of this pandemic. And frankly, we need members of Congress who will. This is a time of dire crisis. There's an eviction wave spreading across the country. 200,000 Americans have died from a preventable pandemic, a crisis that was made worse by not just the idiocy of a criminal president, but also the corporate for-profit predatory healthcare policy paradigm of the generation that preceded me in Congress. And in despite Nancy Pelosi having consistently undermined the needs and interests of working class people, every labor union in San Francisco has endorsed her because she's the incumbent. And labor is more interested in currying power than it is in actually supporting its base. And so our campaign, to some extent, presents a choice to labor: is, will you stand with your leadership and Wall Street, or will you, the rank and file, demonstrate the independence to, and I'm thinking about Thomas Frank's first book, the one that you mentioned, What's the Matter with Kansas? The whole thesis of that book is, why do people vote against their own interests? And I really hope that rank and file labor doesn't get gamed by its leadership, as it has been for generations, into voting against their own interests by supporting tools of Wall Street.
And we Shahid, can do better than that. You have run headlong into the San Francisco political machine. And it's run by Pelosi and Willie Brown. There isn't an actual machine. You can look for it, but I can tell you that they have run a progressive prevention program for local politics for a long time. And Willie Brown has picked each of his successors, Gavin Newsom, and then Ed Lee, who died while he was in office. And now London Breed, who is the current mayor of San Francisco. And Mark Leno is an incredibly adept and experienced politician who got sidelined by the combination of Willie Brown, the tech millionaires and billionaires who funded attacks on Mark Leno, and before that, the sheriff, Ross Mercurimi. And so we have this whole pattern of what I call progressive prevention. And I wonder if you would enumerate that for our listeners across the country and some outside the U.S., because San Francisco has an undeserved reputation as a mecca for progressive politics.
It's both deserved and undeserved. It's a mecca for progressive politics among people in the grassroots. It frankly is what brought me here 20 years ago to study law. And when I got really deeply involved in the movement to try to stop the war in Iraq, it was the local political culture of the Bay Area that frankly inspired me and radicalized me. And when I spent, the next 20 years in San Francisco and Washington fighting the right wing, I still think of that as very much an expression of this city's long established sensibility. Harkening back to the era of the resistance to the Vietnam War and the Beat Poets, I stand in a long tradition of San Franciscans who are motivated by ideas and ideals and hopes of a brighter, more humane future. And that's, I'm very proud to say, I think the ethos of the city, while at the same time, to your point, there is an institutional layer of, I'm using air quotes again, self-described progressive politics that is frankly not so progressive at all. I was subjected to smear campaigns this summer, protecting the establishment, engineered by people I used to employ, basically people who I'd rotated off my primary team when I won the primary in the spring and was able to recruit more experienced staff. And the folks who I replaced on my team, with the support of any number of local press outlets, the San Francisco Chronicle, 48 Hills, Mission Local, there were a number of just straight up lies printed about me. And the local press refused to correct them. It took national press to report on the evidence that my critics knew they were promoting a false narrative at the time that they were smearing me in public. And, it had frankly devastating effects, not just on our campaign, but on the movement. Any number of, again, self-described progressive organizations in the city neutralized themselves. And, they say they care about Medicare for all and universal health care. They say they care about climate justice. They say they care about racial justice, but, every one of those groups, DSA, the Progressive Democrats of America, the San Francisco Bernie-crats, the Tenants Union, the Harvey Milk Democratic Club, each of these organizations have basically rendered their rhetorical commitments to their own principles nothing more than rhetoric by taking themselves out of the first race in a generation in which they actually had a choice to send to Washington someone who agrees with their own stated principles, and they did it because they were willing to disregard evidence and witnesses when a brown person was falsely accused by a white woman. And, you know, it is – I didn't run for Congress to become a poster child for white supremacy in San Francisco or the, you know, the excesses of white supremacy and its emergence within progressive circles. But I think it's really disturbing when self-described progressive groups and socialist groups don't understand their own principles enough to stand up for them when it matters. And due process matters. And, you know, frankly, like due diligence matters. And I've seen so little of both. It has really forced me to a very rude awakening about the depths of the institutional racism in a city that I proudly still construe and aim to represent as this country's most progressive.
Shahid, I view the attacks on you in July in two pieces. One you referenced was kind of the people who had been part of your campaign in the primary exacting some form of retribution because you made some staff changes. And the other was the sexual assault or harassment smear that was originated by Elizabeth Croydon. And I don't wish to try to litigate this. I don't know Elizabeth Croydon. My reading of her allegations against you were that she had much more of a personal vendetta than any kind of a substantial case against you, either on a moral or a legal basis. But I have trouble reconciling how we deal with these kind of allegations, because I felt that Tara Reid deserved much more examination of the allegations that she leveled against Joe Biden. But we saw the machinery sweep in there and the collusion of the media to marginalize Tara Reid, and she damaged her own cause in some respects with her statements and some of her own actions, both before and after she went public. But I have long wrestled with this because I have this history of supporting the rights of the accused. And so I've been very uncomfortable in the Me Too era. Harvey Weinstein is, you know, it's pretty easy to reach a personal judgment about his behavior, and he has been criminally convicted for it. But there are many people who had awkward moments of, you know, an attempt at exchanging messages of sexual attraction that were then turned into, you know, much more claims that were much more substantial and much more damaging. So given what you've been through, could you reflect on how we find a balance while honoring and respecting women who come forward with charges? I don't trivialize that. I don't immediately dismiss it. But at the same time, there are people who make false charges, and we can't let individuals' reputations be destroyed in cases of that type.
You're absolutely right, and I take it's bigger than the reputations of individuals. Like, I might be an individual whose reputation was attacked by a group of, you know, self-interested political campaign operatives. But again, I'm not the victim here. The victim is the movement. The victim is the people in whichever country Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden try to bomb next, right? They're the people ultimately whose interests are at stake here. And so it's not just the reputational interests of the falsely accused. As a candidate for public office, the victims in my case include our entire community and our democracy writ large. That's what was damaged by the smear campaign. And I to reflect on this in a couple different dimensions, I think one really crucial need here is press ethics. You know, I could reflect, and it's appropriate for you to raise Tara Reid, and I think the comparison between Tara Reid and the person who accused me is revealing exactly of the white supremacy that I encountered. Tara Reid is someone who had plenty of corroborating evidence, and it took her months for any media sources to give any airtime to her accusations of pretty severe violation by a powerful, white, wealthy, entrenched incumbent. I am a powerless brown immigrant challenging the very same apparatus politically that Joe Biden represents. My accuser, despite having no corroborating evidence, frankly, and every piece of evidence in this situation suggests that my accuser is not reliable. It's just that I'm being charitable here. There are a lot of things I could say that I'm not going to say. Other people have written about Liz Croydon and their experiences with her. My experience with her includes A, having never indicated any attraction ever at all. B, she's accused me for 5 years of murder. She's accused me of human trafficking. And now recently she's accused me of harassment. And the only reason that this has been in the press is because my former colleagues used Liz's story to get their own concerns into the press. And that's a failure of press ethics, but it's a failure of press ethics with, unfortunately, racist consequences. Because again, when you have people of color presumptively judged in public on the basis of accusations, when we have evidence and witnesses indicating that we didn't do the things that we're accused of, that is racist, whether anyone was prejudiced or not. You know, I don't think that anybody in the Harvey Milk LGBT Democratic Club is racist, but did they subject me to a racist process and promote white supremacy? Hell yeah, they did. And I think Harvey Milk would be aghast at what's happened in the Democratic Club that bears his name. And that club's even rewarded my accusers with leadership positions, even though they did things like out my relationships, which is, you know, wildly unethical and particularly contrary to that community's interests. And just to be clear, I mean, I find that particular club's decision especially revealing because I've fought for gay rights 10 years before Nancy Pelosi in the courts. I was in court fighting for marriage equality 10 years before Nancy Pelosi even accepted that marriage equality for LGBTQ couples should be a federal right. And the so-called progressive LGBTQ club in San Francisco endorsed the incumbent. And it's so, I think gross is the word that I would use. And it delegitimates the institutional establishment here locally. In terms of how to deal with these things better, you know, we should believe women, and that means we should listen to them and heed their concerns enough to investigate. But investigating accusations doesn't mean presuming them all to be true. You know, among the things that were said in club meetings about our campaign, one of my accusers said in a DSA meeting that brown men rape.
Ooh,
which
really?
Is about as racialized an accusation as you could get. It led one of my supporters, an Afro-Latina, whose voice has been also silenced by the local press, Gloria Berry is her name. She reflected after one of these meetings that it felt like she'd left a KKK rally. This is in San Francisco. Why are Afro-Latina grandmothers elected to the Democratic County Central Committee reflecting on meetings of local progressive groups as if they were KKK rallies?
Mm-hmm.
That's a real problem for this city. And, you know, it was made a problem for me, and I am standing on this hill because I was put there. But it's not, frankly, my problem. You know, it's my name being dragged through the mud, but it's a problem for San Francisco and our democracy. And, you know, I think one of the things I would like to see is ethical press. You know, I've seen such revealing demonstrations of incapacity and ethical problems at Mission Local, at 48 Hills, at the Bay Area Reporter, at the San Francisco Chronicle. You know, and some of these outlets are ones that I've respected in the past. You know, when 48 Hills used to do good work as the Bay Guardian, I don't know what happened over there. And it's one thing for the press to fail and just to locate where the failures are, to run a story without independent corroboration that is just amplifying a smear campaign is a failure of press ethics in the first instance. To then refuse to correct the story when evidence emerges that sources who were quoted on the record were promoting a false narrative that they knew to be false at the time, that's newsworthy. But nobody in the local press would cover it.
Yeah.
When you have people being bullied by supposed whistleblowers, you know, my former staff who constructed this smear campaign, they went on to tell lies and bully my current supporters, my current staff, my romantic partners. I mean, it's really gross. And the local press, and this is the key, you talked about Harvey Weinstein. I think the Me Too movement gained prominence by punching up. But it has since become a sword and a shield used by people to punch down. You know, when I was being targeted, I'm still being targeted by the smears, by these same people who've told more lies since about things I haven't done that they say I had. You know, the smear campaign is being launched by people with an interest, and it's not an interest punching up, right? Like Joe Biden, Harvey Weinstein, these are powerful, wealthy white men. I don't have any power. I don't have any authority. I don't have any resources. All I have is an audience and a 20-year history of fighting for Americans' rights. And, you know, the fact that I had an audience made me an attractive target to some people with interests, but it's not punching up. It's punching down at an immigrant challenger to an entrenched corporate incumbent. And when social movements are used as swords and shields to protect the establishment, we should be skeptical. And that's exactly what the press and the organized, self-described, again, air quotes, progressive community in San Francisco was thoroughly unwilling or unable to do.
Mm-hmm. Shahid, turning to another issue that's very important to me, I see bipartisan support for regime change in Caracas. And it really troubles me that Democrats would join people like Elliot Abrams and, you know, some of the darkest figures of the Republican past and support Trump's recognition of Juan Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela, when even under the most, generous reading of the Venezuelan Constitution, he could claim the presidency for 30 days starting in mid-January of 2019. And yet the U.S. is continuing. Secretary of State Pompeo circled Venezuela this past week, handing out party cash to friendly leaders who will support the phony Lima group and get behind the U.S. Effort to depose a man who was elected, who presides over a very difficult situation that is made dire by U.S. sanctions. And the media is shockingly biased in its coverage of the whole situation, including PBS. The NewsHour had an extremely biased pro-Guaido report just the other night. And it shocks me, again, to see those who opposed regime change wars in the Middle East when Bush was president now just kind of say, oh, yeah, Maduro's bad. A coup by the United States is to be expected. Let's see what's on Netflix.
I mean, this goes to your point from maybe 20 minutes ago about the troubling emergence of neoconservatism within the Democratic Party. There is absolutely a through thread, and it is entirely bipartisan, connecting the last 70 years of U.S. foreign policy. And the through thread is belligerent military interventions to open foreign markets to U.S. companies. That's the story of U.S. foreign policy. It explains every intervention across the global South. It explains every intervention across the Middle East. And it explains the continuing interest in Venezuela. Juan Guaido was welcomed to Washington at a press conference at which Nancy Pelosi spoke by his shoulder. Mm-hmm. This is a figure who is one among three potential beneficiaries across Latin America, including the now president of Brazil, Bolsonaro, beneficiaries of CIA interventions, likely. I can't prove it, but I suspect it. It fits the longstanding pattern. There's plenty of documents to be found. We haven't seen them, largely because Nancy Pelosi, as the House Speaker, prevents every member of Congress, except for a handful of her handpicked deputies, from having access to staff members with security clearance. So most members of Congress can't actually investigate the executive branch. They don't have clearance to look at the documents, which is one reason why the history of the interventions across Latin America over the last 2 years remains entirely suppressed, just like the evidence of CIA torture, which includes, you know, we've talked about this particular issue many times. There's thousands of photos. There is video depicting offenses as severe as rape and outright murder, and they have not seen the light of day because you mentioned the Secretary of State, Pompeo. He was the CIA director before, and the current CIA director is an unrepentant torture enabler who tried to destroy, in fact, did destroy at least some evidence in order to hide evidence of the CIA's criminal trail. And so instead of holding torturers accountable, we promoted them all. And that's one of the reasons why this foreign policy paradigm has unfortunately grown only more entrenched. And at the end of the day, as much as we need to ensure that Congress shows up for the needs of Americans struggling in crisis, shows up for universal health care, shows up for climate justice, shows up for rent and mortgage relief, we also need to make sure that our role in the world is one that is not just humane, but at least respectful of human rights in other places and not committed to engineering unnecessary national security threats. And that's what we have now. You know, we have such a belligerent, ham-fisted, self-interested foreign policy that is abusive to human rights in other places that we seem to be committed to driving recruits into the arms of our enemies. And the more that we stand for human rights, the more we advance U.S. national security interests, the more we prove willing to undermine human rights in the service of our GDP, the more we undermine U.S. national security. We have to understand better what national security means. It doesn't mean Wall Street. It doesn't mean which policy is going to help the Dow Jones Industrial Average. National security means what will keep Americans alive. And, you know, Washington, the Beltway, and our so-called national security agencies don't have a great deal of interest in that, it seems.
Shahid, I want to direct people to your website, which is shahidforchange.us. S-H-A-H-I-D is Mr. Bitar's first name. And I recommend that people visit because you outline your positions on a whole array of important issues. We didn't have time to talk about all of them, but as we get ready to wrap up here, I want to get your views on climate change and climate justice, and I'm glad that you linked those two issues. Before he sold out, Van Jones was, to me, the most attractive proponent of the linkage of climate justice with the efforts to address the human contributions to warming of the planet. And here at this podcast, we've had a running conversation since April with listeners about Planet of the Humans. And most recently, I interviewed Max Blumenthal about his excellent expose of those individuals who tried so hard to shut down the release of the film, to prevent its distribution, to outright censor it. They are all linked to this corporate-funded exploitation of climate change. And these are people who expect to be able to rack up big profits by embracing some form of a Green New Deal. And while Planet of the Humans has flaws, and I don't dismiss them, I think its central point was to get the climate movement to engage in some self-examination. And I believe that the rapidity of the change and the exponential speed that we are seeing it develop calls for a rethinking of alliances with corporate entities and a need to really address this in a much more significant crisis management way. So that's a very long-winded question, and let me shut up and ask you for your comments about the various issues I raised there.
Yeah, climate change and chaos and catastrophe will be the defining issue of the next century. They already are. And just to be clear, the climate crisis is killing Californians, and it has been every year for the past several. And it's not just the number of people who die in these wildfires or who lose their homes. Literally, the entire West Coast, and frankly, much of the country beyond it, was choking on the air this month. The sky was red at high noon in San Francisco on the 9th of September, which I describe as literally like written in the sky, the need for dramatic, urgent, exigent change. We cannot continue to blindly stumble down the path of for-profit resource extraction and pretend that anyone's grandkids are going to be left alive at the end of it. There is a bipartisan agreement in Washington to kick future generations off a cliff because it will put money in the pockets of Wall Street investors. And just to be clear here, you know, the Green New Deal is an imperative. I'm absolutely committed to it. The incumbent who I'm challenging in the general election derides it as a dream or whatever. Beyond that, I would like to nationalize fossil fuel industries. There is no good reason that we incentivize through the money incentive resource plunder. To be clear, when we pull things out of the ground, we are robbing the future. Our legal system doesn't recognize that in any way, but it is inescapably true. It doesn't even matter what the resource is. If it's aluminum, if it's oil, if you're pulling it out of the ground, there's necessarily depletion. It robs the future. That stuff isn't ours to begin with. And this is, you know, this is informed to some extent by conceptions of property that we can learn from the indigenous communities that were subjected to a genocide in the United States. But that wisdom really matters now. And what theoretical claim can anybody make to things that are in the ground that they didn't put there? Things that long preceded them, things that are ultimately a birthright for the future. And instead, we're pulling them out of the ground to burn them to accelerate a climate crisis to make some people rich in the present. I mean, it's just absolutely idiotic. And so the Green New Deal is critical. Nationalizing fossil fuels industries is critical. I want to bring back another intersection. We've talked at a couple different times over the last hour about U.S. foreign policy. There's a critical foreign policy intersection with climate justice. The Pentagon is the planet's largest institutional source of pollution, carbon pollution. And what we use it for is to pull more oil out of somebody else's soil. And so in both of these dimensions, we can't secure climate justice without getting a handle on our own military-industrial complex. This is why Dr. King described racism and capitalism and militarism as intersecting issues. In his era, what he described as threatened everywhere by injustice was justice. Now, when we continue to fail to heed his warnings, what we are inviting is a global catastrophe. It's not just justice everywhere that is threatened. It is the capacity of our only home to support human life. And, you know, people talk about we have to save the planet. The planet will be just fine. And we can't pretend that it's the planet you're trying to save. We have to save everyone's grandchildren. They're the ones at risk. And they're the ones, frankly, that no one in Washington seems to care very much about. I care very much about the future. And that's why I'm running for office today to defend it.
Well, Shahid, it's great to visit with you. You're running, I think, a campaign on issues that are really significant and very pressing. I do want to acknowledge that you got 13% in the primary, which enabled you, under our top two rules, to face off as Democrat to Democrat against Nancy Pelosi in November. But it still remains an uphill climb, and I want to encourage listeners who are interested to check out your website. If you make donations, consider contributing to Shahid's campaign. And Shahid, Nancy Pelosi indicated back in 2018 that she did not intend to seek re-election in 2022. Does that promise still hold, or is that like the Republicans on Supreme Court nominees?
You know, I don't know what to believe from Nancy Pelosi anymore. She claims to stand for migrant rights while funding concentration camps. You know, she claims to stand for reproductive rights while endorsing reproductive authoritarians in Texas and Illinois. She claims to fight the president while signing his bills. So, yeah, I don't put a great deal of faith in that promise.
All right. Well, I wish you the best. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Peter. Always great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with congressional candidate Shahid Buttar. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you.